Tracing the route of migrant kids back to Guatemala. Today, Tuesday, July 8th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Central American migrants make the dangerous trek north through Mexico trying to reach the U.S. Their journey starts along Mexico's poorest border with Guatemala.
The vast majority of Mexico's southern border is absolutely wide open.
The U.S.-Mexico border is wide open, too, at least when it comes to soccer. Tijuana's professional team is a big fan base in Southern California. Part of its appeal? A Mexican-American midfielder named, and I'm not making this up, Joe Corona.
Joe Corona is kind of the poster boy of what the team wants to be. We're not a Mexican club. We're not an American club. We're a border club.
Plus, we remember the Argentine superstar many think was the best soccer player never to make it to the World Cup. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. How do you solve a humanitarian crisis at the border? That's what President Obama has called the flood of children traveling on their own to the U.S. from Central America. Tens of thousands of these undocumented children have been detained at the U.S.-Mexico border since October. Today, President Obama asked Congress for nearly $4 billion in emergency funding to help cope with the surge at the border. But why are so many Central Americans making the trip in the first place? I spoke with Frank Contreras, who's been reporting for CCTV from Mexico's border with Guatemala.
Well, that border is absolutely porous, Marco. It's a place where there are 12 legal crossing points between Mexico and Central America, 10 of them with Guatemala and 2 with Belize. But the vast majority of Mexico's southern border is absolutely wide open. And the other day, I was on a boat with a number of immigrants coming from all over Central America, mostly Hondurans. And we came into Mexico straight in, landed the boat on Mexican shores, and just kind of walked right into the country without seeing any sort of immigration official, police official, or anybody from the Mexican government for that matter.
Right. One of the things you focused on, Frank, are how these migrants, some of them refugees, are being targeted by gangs. I mean, even before getting across Mexican territory, they're already targets of prey.
It appears what they do is they go after the most vulnerable. And in many cases, that does include women who are traveling alone. I interviewed a number of women who were traveling alone, and one of them was carrying an infant child who was just about a couple of months old. So there you go, a woman traveling, carrying her baby, and compare that to, you know, a stronger guy in his mid-20s carrying a backpack. So which one would you go after? Which one is more vulnerable? And that's what happens. You see them going after the youngest people, the children. And not only that, Marco, they're actually targeted inside their own homes. One woman from San Pedro Sula told me this horrific story. She said she and her husband were at home in the afternoon having lunch, and then suddenly a couple of gangsters came in. They broke down the door and basically threatened them at gunpoint and then stole all their food. Then they took over the house and told them that if they came back, they would be murdered. And I heard a number of different stories of this nature, people feeling this kind of armed threat inside their own homes.
Right. And so it's the gang members, it's these gangs, it's this violent life that's pushing these people to leave?
Well, that's definitely one major cause for people I spoke with. People are still citing issues of poverty as well, Marco. As you know, Central America remains one of the most poverty-stricken areas in all of the Americas, and people are having a hard time both with their economic well-being and with their safety. A lot of people who I spoke with were under 17 years old, young boys mostly. They tried to find jobs, but the only thing they could do was get enough money to buy food each day.
When you ask these people along the Mexico-Guatemala border why they're going to the U.S., what do they say? Are they all going to the U.S.?
They're all hoping to go to the U.S. One woman I spoke with said she'd be happy to stay in Mexico if Mexico would accept her. And, you know, Mexico and the United States at this moment are facing pressure from the United Nations. The United Nations would like to see these two countries open the way for more asylum cases because they believe that a good number of these migrants who are traveling should be treated as refugees who are displaced by armed conflicts. Usually you think of armed conflicts, things that are happening in the Middle East or in Africa, you know, where you have traditional kinds of wars. The fact that they involve gangs makes it really somewhat unusual.
You know, Frank, the White House is taking a lot of heat from political opponents for all these kids from Guatemala, from Central America, coming up through Mexico into the United States. But what is Mexico doing about it? I mean, it's not like this trek began at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, Mexico knows that it's going to have a serious responsibility in what's taking place here. On Monday, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto met with the president of Guatemala, Otto Pérez Molina, and they created a new plan, Marco, that sounds very similar to what the United States wants to do with Mexico. They want to see safe and orderly passage on Mexico's southern border. They want protection of immigrants' rights. They created this new plan, Marco, that's going to include temporary visitors cards and temporary work cards for regional visitors. People who live along the border in Guatemala, Belize, places like that, will be able to get these cards and come into Mexico for 3 days. So this is the kind of thing that Mexico is starting to create.
Frank Contreras with CCTV America, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Marco.
We're going to shift gears here and talk about a different kind of cross-border story. This one has to do with soccer. Even though the U.S. made a respectable showing at the World Cup, it's no soccer powerhouse. Yet, one soccer club in Mexico, the Xolos, is finding success by adding American players with Mexican roots to its roster. And other Mexican teams are taking note. Kiko Fujita has a story from Tijuana.
Game day at Estadio Caliente in Tijuana. It looks like a typical big American sporting event. Fans tailgate decked in team colors, red and black. One group of supporters, known as the Massacre, rallies the crowds. And the team's logo, a hairless dog, is everywhere. It's like this at fever pitch for 90 minutes. It's what you'd expect from any Mexican soccer game. But the Tijuana Xolos isn't your typical Mexican club. They play just south of the California border. Many of their fans drive in from the U.S. And their star player, a Mexican-American who commutes from San Diego.
Yeah, well, I didn't really see myself playing in Mexico, but I wanted to play professional soccer, so that was my goal. I mean, no matter where I was.
That's Joe Corona, a laid-back 23-year-old midfielder. He was born in California to a Mexican dad and a mom from El Salvador. He played soccer a lot growing up, and eventually he scored a scholarship to play at San Diego State University. And that's just when the Xolos in Mexico started gaining steam. So when a friend encouraged Corona to try out for the Mexican club, he had mixed feelings.
I remember it was like 1 month of thinking about it, like, should I stay at San Diego State or should I come and try it out in Mexico and to make my dream come true.
Corona chose the Xolos, and within 2 years, he helped the club win their first league title, kind of like winning the Super Bowl here. Johnny Aviles, a writer for the website Soccerly, says Corona was one of several Mexican-American players who've had a crucial role in the Xolos' success.
Joe Corona is the poster boy of what the team wants to be, that we're not a Mexican club, we're not an American club, we're a border club.
Aviles says that until the Xolos rose up, clubs rarely gave Mexican-Americans a look. The stigma was that American soccer was considered clumsy and lacking in skill.
Mexican soccer has always been about Mexicans or, you know, the big money foreigners that they bring in, the big Argentine, the big Brazilian.
Aviles also said that players like Corona, even with dual citizenship, sometimes weren't considered real Mexicans. But the Tijuana club embraces them. They see their proximity to the States as an edge. They've set up a training academy near the border, held tryouts near L.A., and recruited young Mexican-American players into their junior leagues. And now other elite Mexican clubs like Chivas and Club America have followed suit. It's an effort that's now brought more than 20 Mexican-American players to Mexico, who might have never gotten noticed by Major League Soccer recruiters in the U.S.
MLS does a lot of recruiting from college, and Mexican-American population in the U.S. is not a demographic that sends a lot of kids to college. So the dream to play professionally for these kids was to kind of leave home and contest their luck in Mexico.
And these players can still live in the U.S. But still, you'd think that playing between two cultures could make for some messy loyalties. Take Joe Corona. He plays for a Mexican team, but he was also picked to play for the U.S. national team. But that's not something his fans in Tijuana see as a problem.
Pues mira, es una identidad que le ha dado Tijuana. Tijuana es, pues ahora sí que las dos Californias, San Diego, Tijuana.
This fan says the Xolos represent Tijuana, both Baja California and Southern California. Corona agrees, and he hopes to see more soccer players and fans like him crossing the border with ease, catching games on either side. For the world, I'm Akiko Fujita, Tijuana.
And if you want to see that hairless dog mascot, and you should because hairless dogs are freaky cute, we've got that along with other pics from the Tijuana pitch. They're all at PRI.org. Now, what's a game of soccer without that sea of green to play on? It's got to be sturdy, though. Soccer pitches take a beating, especially at the World Cup in Brazil. All those slides and dramatic dives can tear up the turf, though it always seems to look pretty good on TV. But the grass at the Cup isn't native to Brazil. It comes from thousands of miles north in Manitoba, Canada. Terry Scott is with Pixseed, the company that supplied the seed for the Cup, and he's been following the games from Winnipeg.
Yeah, it's been an exciting World Cup.
You know the answer to this one, Terry Scott. What's the secret to this green and lush-looking soccer fields, fields on display at the World Cup? Where does that grass come from?
Traditionally in Brazil, they have Bermuda grass soccer pitches, but the Bermuda grass goes dormant at this time of the year and turns brown, so it doesn't look very good from the TV. So perennial ryegrass is the grass of choice. It germinates quickly, it grows quickly, it's an aggressive grass, and it's a grass that we can successfully grow with our seed production farmers up here in Manitoba, Canada.
Is it true that more than a billion ryegrass seeds harvested there in Manitoba went to Brazil for these World Cup fields?
Well, that would just do one soccer pitch.
Just one.
So it would be certainly a lot more than that. Perennial ryegrass generally is about 300,000 seeds per pound. And you have to put on quite a few pounds on a soccer pitch. So it ends up about a billion seeds on one soccer pitch.
I mean, the grass is extraordinarily green. It's a really beautiful color. But here's the thing. Manitoba is Canada. We're talking Brazil, the tropics. How does this Manitoba ryegrass seed actually fare in a place like Brazil?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the perennial ryegrass, the characteristics of some of the varieties, of course, have the ability to handle the heat and humidity, but also can handle cooler temperatures, which in certain parts of Brazil is the case as you get into higher altitudes there. So it does manage a lot of different conditions.
What other sports events has Manitoba ryegrass seed gone to? Anything famous?
It goes in a mix, football stadiums, golf courses, things like that. We did provide the seed, which was mostly perennial ryegrass, for the 2010 South Africa World Cup. And we also did the Euro Cup in 2012, which was in the Ukraine and Poland. It's interesting because up here in Canada, we use perennial ryegrass in our turf mixes, but perennial ryegrass doesn't survive our cold winters up here in Manitoba when it's minus 30 degrees. It just doesn't survive well over our winters. So it does better as you get a little bit south of here in terms of a permanent grass year-round.
So, Terry, you're the vice president of this grass seed company there in Winnipeg. Your front lawn better be looking good.
I don't know if I should take all the credit, but we've had a fair amount of rain this year, this spring, and my front lawn looks fabulous.
Terry Scott, a vice president at Pixseed in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Safe to say that Iraq is a mess right now. The Sunni militant group ISIS seems to be in control of large parts of the country, north and west of the capital. But Baghdad is now seeing its share of violence, too, in the form of ISIS suicide attacks. And there are also other troubles in Baghdad originating in the Green Zone, home of Iraq's parliament. Politicians there cannot agree on who's going to hold the country's three top jobs. Laith Kuba was a spokesman for the Iraqi government after the fall of Saddam Hussein. He's now an analyst for the National Endowment for Democracy. I asked him exactly what's going on.
Prior to parliament meeting first time, they need to agree on who's going to be a president, who's going to be head of the parliament, and who's going to be a prime minister. This is a consequence of the parliament to meet, and those names ought to be nominated. And because there is no consensus at all on which names are out there, nobody wants to hold that meeting. Everything is locked in about whether or not Maliki is putting his name forward, or is there going to be an alternative name.
Right. And is the lack of consensus, what's that due to?
Well, lack of consensus is a much deeper issue. I think Iraq has reached a new phase. The Kurds have more or less developed their own vision and their own track, and I think they want to go their own way. Sunni areas now are locked into a different reality, and there is zero agreement or consensus on having Maliki to continue. And amongst the Shias, there are strong differences about Maliki and, of course, about his replacement. So the country really is in a crisis. And although there is a constitution still functioning, but the political process has withered, and I think it's about to fail.
If ISIS was not in Iraq, do you think the parliament in Baghdad would have a speaker by now, a president, a prime minister?
No. I think ISIS complicated the situation. I think presence of ISIS has made it much clearer why Maliki must go. But despite that, Maliki is insisting on staying. Without ISIS, I think Maliki for sure would have stayed, and for sure we would have Sunnis revolting and boycotting him. And for sure, we would have very angry Kurds who don't want to work with him. So he has become a divisive prime minister.
Laith Kuba, take out the sordid years of Saddam Hussein. You've been in the Iraqi government. Have you ever seen the government there this dysfunctional?
No. I think the Iraqi government benefited from, let's say, the blessing and the support from both the U.S. and Iran. And I think the Turks and the Saudis might have been uncomfortable, but they lived with it. It benefited from oil revenues in hundreds of billions of dollars. So it has every reason to succeed. And if it's failing, as I said, it's just because of the bad politics and bad politicians. And unfortunately, we have a constitution which is sound and I think can work, but the constitution by itself would not deliver without institutions and some mature players.
And as for that parliament building itself, I mean, it's always good to get a sense of the physical place where things are failing and dysfunction is setting in. Where is the parliament building in Baghdad? What does it look like? And what can you tell us about the place?
There are grand designs now by a known Iraqi architect to design some great building, but that's for the future. Currently, they're using one of the main halls that were used before for the people's meetings. It is within the green zone, and this is where they meet.
Laith Kuba, former spokesman for the Iraqi government, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laith broke things down there in Iraq's political arena, but we know there are still many more questions about what else is happening in Iraq. We'll answer your questions tomorrow morning on Facebook with David Patel, a Middle East expert at Brandeis University. Join us tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time at facebook.com/PRI the world. It may not be obvious, but natural resources or the lack of natural resources can add to political unrest. That scenario is called a threat multiplier in Pentagon speak, and it's happening right now in Iraq with water. Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist and writer for Slate. He says militant groups in Iraq are taking advantage of the country's drought to squeeze Baghdad by controlling the water flow to the capital.
ISIS is starting to use those dams as a weapon of war. So they've made high on their list to take over those dams and control the water downstream. So one of their plans is to kind of control the flow to the Shiite area of Iraq, which is in the southern part of Iraq. So they're kind of in control of the natural resources of the country when you think about water right now.
And when you say they control it, they literally are controlling a kind of giant spigot upstream. They can do what they want with that water.
Yeah. And actually, as they were taking over the dam around Mosul, I think one report that I read said that they intentionally released a lot of water downstream to kind of flood out the enemy in advance. So they are controlling the tap and marshalling that natural resource of the country.
Right. ISIS obviously wants to control that, but you're kind of also saying there's this connection between drought and climate change. So is ISIS just going to have to be dealing with less and less water?
Well, I mean, the thing is, just in the last winter, Iraq has gone through a drought similar to that one of Syria from 2006 to 2010. So they had about half the amount of rainfall they normally do. So as water becomes more scarce, then it becomes more important, you know, especially for those farmers that are still left trying to make a productive living in Iraq. And we've seen kind of that similar flood of ex-farmers from the fields to the cities in Iraq over the last year. And, you know, there is that scenario that history could repeat itself.
How certain are scientists of the connection between drought in this part of the world and climate change?
I think, as with every major weather or climate event, it's difficult to directly connect it. But the climate models forecast a general drying of the Mediterranean region, and that includes the Middle East. What we're seeing is that drying trend happening a bit faster than the computer models are forecasting.
Now, on top of that, there's also the connection between high temperatures and political instability, which was actually studied in the magazine Science last year, showing a correlation. But hasn't that always been the case? I mean, the French Revolution blew up in the middle of July, 1789.
Yeah, I think that that's not necessarily something that's new. But if you have more and more hot days, then there are more and more, in theory, chances for that kind of trigger to happen if people are more violent during hot weather.
Hmm. I mean, you pointed out earlier that the Pentagon considers climate change and intense drought threat multipliers. But in some ways, do you feel, as a meteorologist, that maybe the problems start with water and the militants are the threat multipliers?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the case with the Middle East, is that I don't think anyone's trying to say that climate change is the root cause of violence in the Middle East. But I think that there is some truth to that statement where climate change is definitely not making it better. You know, if you have persistent drying, more frequent droughts, more kind of weather instability and higher temperatures, then that's just kind of aggravating the situation, where if you have an underlying tension, that gives more and more chances for that tension to kind of explode into violence.
Yeah, not a very encouraging story. Eric Holthaus, writer and the weatherman with Slate, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're tuned to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, in April, Islamic extremists kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria. The Nigerian government vowed to bring them back. So far, the government's got nothing to show for its efforts.
It's almost like they're kidnapping the girls all over again, and be more convinced every day that those with the duty of finding the girls are as confused as ever.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's looking a lot like war right now across Israel and the Gaza Strip. Air raid sirens sounded in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv today, a sign of rocket attacks on Israel's two main cities. Palestinian militants have fired dozens of rockets into Israel. And the Israeli military has launched a major bombing campaign in Gaza. Palestinian officials say at least 15 people have been killed there in airstrikes. Earlier, I spoke with our BBC colleague Yolande Nell, who's reporting from Gaza City.
Well, I arrived in the Gaza Strip through the Erez crossing from Israel early this morning, and Israeli airstrikes were taking place as we arrived, and they've been coming thick and fast ever since. You get these huge, loud thuds that make the ground shake, and these big plumes of smoke go up. The first ones we saw around Beit Lahia in the north of the Gaza Strip, but then here in Gaza City, there was an explosion in the middle of the day. Very graphic pictures of what happened on Palestinian TV. There were three Palestinian militants who were killed, all leaders of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the Hamas militant wing. And we went earlier to their funeral. Huge crowds turned out to watch them getting buried. the most serious incident of the day has been in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. This is where a house was hit by an Israeli airstrike. We're told that 7 people were there, including 3 children. Now, apparently, there was notification from the Israeli military that they were going to attack this house, but the response, so we understand, of the family and of local people was to try to make their way to the roof to try to protect the house from being attacked. But instead, there was an airstrike, 7 people killed there, including the 3 children.
I mean, you mentioned that notification. It's kind of crazy how this kind of military engagement works on the Israeli side. They are supposed to make a phone call to the house that they're about to strike. What do they tell the Palestinian residents inside?
They basically tell them to get out. It's called the knock-on roof policy. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes leafleting is used as well. But this is something that has been seen, although obviously it's not always effective in having the results they want. There's also been a lot of people wounded here in the Gaza Strip through the day as a result of the airstrikes, not because they've been targeted directly, but when we were at the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City earlier speaking to the doctors, they said they're seeing more people coming in now with shrapnel injuries. Mm. And there, they're very worried about what to do because they're running out of medical supplies. And they say if this crisis continues, then very quickly petrol will run out for the generators and they won't have the medicines that they need because, of course, there are already tight border restrictions imposed on Gaza by Israel and by Egypt. And that can mean that resources there run low.
Yolan, just briefly, what have you been hearing from Palestinians, Hamas leaders? Does it seem like they want things to escalate with Israel?
Well, there were some very defiant statements coming out from the Al-Qassam Brigades, the militant wing of Hamas, also from the Al-Quds Brigades of the Islamic Jihad, the other main militant faction here. They said that red lines had been crossed with the targeting of civilian homes. But at the same time, we also had a member of the Al-Qassam Brigades, a spokesperson, coming out laying down the conditions for a ceasefire. These are not conditions I think that Israel will adhere to. They're asking for an end to what they call the aggression in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, also in Jerusalem. They want to see many of the prisoners who have recently been sent back to Israeli jails, those who are released under the terms of the Gilad Shalit deal. Remember, he was the captured Israeli soldier who was held here in Gaza for 5 years. They want those prisoners to be re-released. And they're also asking Israel to make other concessions that at the moment I think it's unlikely to make, but at least perhaps some suggestion this evening that there is a request for some kind of calm on the Palestinian side as the casualties mount up.
My colleague Yolande Nell at the BBC in Gaza City. Americans continue to debate Obamacare. In Turkey, universal health care has been around since 2003. It's been extremely popular and helped boost support for the ruling party and Prime Minister Erdogan. But there does seem to be a downside to the program, at least for Turkey's doctors. It's not an economic problem. Instead, Turkish doctors say that since the country instituted free health care, they're experiencing high rates of physical abuse. Dalia Mortada has a story from Istanbul.
The first time I met Özgül Pamukçu, it was to talk about sexual harassment in Istanbul. We agreed, it's a huge problem. But then she said, for me, it's even worse at work. I was shocked because, well, she's a doctor.
It's like a terrorism or like a nightmare being in the outpatient clinic.
Pamukçu says, like in so many places in the world, the clinic is crowded. People are agitated and she has to get through as many patients as possible, sometimes up to 70 each shift. But what makes it really unbearable is the abuse. Like the one time a man screamed at her and said he could do a better job caring for his sick daughter.
He starts to shout at me and then came to me and then just kicking me, some pushed me, and then security came about a half an hour later. But every day in the outpatient clinic, we are facing verbal violence as well.
Pamukçu considers herself lucky. She's only been attacked a few times by patients or their relatives in the 4 years since graduating from med school. She says emergency room doctors have it worse.
Ben Caner Çelik, 6 yıllık hekimim.
Caner Çelik's been an ER doctor for 3 years.
Hasta ya da hasta yakınının şiddetine maruz kalmak en çok korkunç şey bu.
Çelik says where he works, things get violent all the time. Doctors are often treated as if they're the ones who injured the patients, who shot or stabbed them.
Ondan önceki bir olayı da bahsedeyim mesela aklıma gelen. Bir arkadaşımızın omzu çıktı.
Çelik says in just the past couple of years, a colleague had his shoulder dislocated, another was attacked with 19-inch knives, and a secretary was assaulted so viciously she ended up in a coma. The stories get more shocking the more you hear them. And the thing is, you hear them a lot. A recent study found that 70% of doctors have been attacked. Around 90% have witnessed violence at work. So why is this happening so much? No one could really explain it, but some, including my friend Özgül Pamukçu, blame the government. In 2003, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced, "The days that doctors are regarded as above people are over."
If your prime minister used this kind of speech, then it's normal from everyone accept this kind of behaviors.
That speech was part of Erdogan's AKP government's push for universal health care. But besides instituting free care at public facilities, the law banned doctors who worked at public hospitals from having private practices on the side. Doctors argued the private clinics supplemented their measly public salary. But people decried doctors as insensitive and money-grubbing. The government says it hasn't demonized anyone. In fact, a spokeswoman says via email that the AKP has prioritized health workers' safety. The woman, a doctor-turned-politician, heads a new commission to investigate violence against doctors, and she says the new system is a model of healthcare that's met all of Turkey's needs. In the waiting room at one of Istanbul's public hospitals, Ramazan Ercan says the government has done a great job.
15 yıldan önce çok çok iyi. Biz 15 yıl önce ilaç bulamazdık.
Before 2003, Ercan says he couldn't afford to get treated for his migraines. He could never get a doctor's appointment. Now, the system is easy and free, so he's happy. Erdogan says he knows that violence against doctors is an issue, but he doesn't think it's because people hate doctors. He says it's more of a cultural thing.
Hayır, ben herhangi bir şiddet görmedim.
Turkish people are way too impatient. They get angry too quickly, Erdogan says. But we need to look at things from the patient's perspective. In the end, someone is sick, and that can be scary and raises stress levels. The government says its new commission has led to more than 14,000 cases of violence against doctors being prosecuted in the past 2 years. They've convicted nearly 1,000. There's also a lot more security in hospitals, according to the government. And there's an abuse hotline to report cases of violence as they're happening, kind of like a doctor's 911. Welcome to the Health Ministry's White Coat Hotline to report verbal or physical abuse, it announces. To file a complaint, please press 5. But things can't change soon enough for people like Caner Çelik and his wife, Sinem, who's also an emergency room doctor. Sinem says she's given so much of her life to becoming a doctor, years of education and working long hours, only to find that she fears for her safety. She says if she had to do it all over again, she wouldn't study to be a doctor. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
It's just shy of 100 days since those 276 girls in northern Nigeria were abducted by the Muslim extremists Boko Haram. And Nigeria has seen more bombings and abductions since the girls vanished. Just yesterday, officials in Nigeria announced that yet another group of girls and women had been abducted a few weeks ago, but they managed to escape. Journalist and lawyer Chude Jidonwo says it's difficult to distinguish fact and fiction in Nigeria's many kidnapping cases.
3 weeks ago, when these girls were kidnapped in a village called, I think, Damboa, the Nigerian security forces denied the report that more women had been kidnapped. So it was really strange to see the same forces now say that the women that hadn't been kidnapped had been released. It symbolizes the confusion around the rescue efforts.
Right, so a lot of assumptions posing as facts and no real clear details. Is that the same case for those 276 girls kidnapped in mid-April that started the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls campaign?
Yes, it's exactly the case. The chief of defense staff in Nigeria said 1 month or two ago that he knew the exact location of the girls. And then last week, military spokespeople said they do not know where the girls are. You know, it's just a pretty distressing state of affairs. It's almost like they're kidnapping the girls all over again, because it's one thing to have these girls missing and for us to be confident that every single best effort is being applied to solve this problem. It's another to have the girls missing and be more convinced every day that those with the duty of finding the girls are as confused as ever.
in Abuja, the capital of Nigeria, those daily protests on behalf of the missing girls, those continue, yeah?
Yes, they do continue under the most relentless, shameful attacks by the Nigerian government. The police force in Abuja first asked protesters not to protest anymore, and protesters had to take them to court to get an injunction against them. And then they withdrew the security protection for the protesters. Then government buses shipped in counter-protesters who attacked the Bring Back Our Girls protesters in Abuja. We are also working towards hoping that these girls don't stay there for 100 days. But if they are there in 100 days, we will be taking our protests to the presidency once again to demand actual feedback on what's happening with the girls.
There really seems to be no let-up in Nigeria. I mean, both the big headlines and small items. I mean, small-scale kidnappings by Boko Haram extremists go on weekly almost. So do bombings in several Nigerian states.
Each time bombs have happened, once or twice, the president has said this is the global trend. And maybe it is Nigeria's turn, and this is not a paraphrase, and has compared our country to the war torn Iraq and to Afghanistan at various periods of time. There is a sense that this is a problem beyond us that we get from the top. I mean, I was appalled when the bombs happened in June, just before the World Cup in Abuja, in the center, in a busy shopping mall, killed almost 20, you know, and we tweeted for a few minutes, you know, there was outrage, it trended. And we're back to watching football, you know, and tweeting about football. We can't afford as citizens to let this become a way of life.
You're in New York right now, Jude, on a book tour. And it so happened that last week you were riding in a hotel elevator and an Israeli said to you, you see what's happening in Iraq? It looks like Boko Haram wants to do the same thing in Nigeria. What kind of response did you have to that man?
He said to me, you know, the Islamics want to run down your country and take over the government. And, you know, nobody has ever quite put it in such a stark way. I mean, apart from my president comparing Nigeria with Iraq, I have never compared our country with Iraq. So I reacted, you know, immediately in almost an annoyance. I said, no, it can never happen, you know. Because you know, this is just a fringe group in the Northeast. And he says, well, that's how it started in other parts of the world. And if your government isn't winning the war, isn't stopping the bombs from spreading to other states, then give me one good reason why what is happening with ISIS in Iraq will not happen with Boko Haram in Nigeria. And honestly, I take no pleasure in saying this. I honestly couldn't and still cannot think of a legitimate, logical response to such a question, because no matter what the government tries to say in Nigeria, we are not winning this war against terror.
And as you say, we are closing in on 100 days since those 276 girls were kidnapped. For you, what are those girls still a symbol of?
For me, they are a symbol of a steady march into anarchy. And Anarchy. Yeah. I take no pleasure in using bombastic words. But that is the reality of our situation. It's a steady march. You know, they represent for us our failure as citizens, because many of us allow the government to get away with these things. We allow them to divide us on basis of religion and ethnicity. And it doesn't matter that the North is predominantly Muslim and I'm a Christian. We are all Nigerians. We allow our government get away with serial incompetence. It also stands as a symbol that our country is certainly nowhere close where we want it to be as Nigerians. And that's why, in the midst of the continuous, you know, crises and bombs and abductions, we have stuck with that symbol of these 276 girls. Because for us, if those girls are brought back home, then a bit of the faith we have in our country and its future can begin to be restored.
Nigerian journalist and lawyer Chude Jidonwo, his latest book is Are We the Turning Point Generation? Thank you.
Thank you.
You're tuned to The World and PRI.org. This is Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I want to take a moment to tell you about Vasily Mitrokhin. Born in Russia in 1922, and though he died a decade ago, he's making news this week thanks to a batch of old documents that are coming to light. Mitrokhin was a Soviet spy in the 1960s. He lost faith in communism, but he still showed up for work, the KGB's archives, where he set about hand-copying one document after another. He hid the copies in a milk churn buried outside Moscow. Mitrokhin followed that routine for decades. Then, in 1992, just after the Soviet Union fell apart, Mitrokhin passed those KGB secrets on to the West. A According to Christopher Andrew with Cambridge University, the handover took place at a British embassy in one of the newly independent Baltic states, which one has never been confirmed. As Andrew explains, Mitrokhin showed up and tried explaining to a junior diplomat at the embassy the value of what he had.
He pulls out of his roll-along case some material which he says comes from the files of the illegals, in other words, the Holy of Holies. And he knows that some of this will check out with Western intelligence agencies. They'll know that it is gold dust. And the young woman, young female diplomat, who still doesn't want her name to be known, but I'm sure she'll put it in her memoirs, realizes that this is worth checking out. So instead of turning him away, she produces the sentence which makes me proud to be British, and no other diplomat in any other country could have said, "Would you like a cup of tea?"
Mitrokhin's documents ended up at Cambridge University, where they were kept under lock and key, but now the university has released them. Together, they make up a fascinating picture of the illegals Christopher Andrew mentioned, Soviet agents hiding among the local populations of other countries, something that, Andrew says, hasn't changed much.
Wherever Russia is seeking to exercise influence in the world, it's reasonable to entertain the possibility that an illegal is there.
Spy versus spy still going strong. Finally today, move over Messi, move over Maradona. The Argentine soccer hero of all time is Alfredo Di Stefano. He died on Monday at the age of 88. The Blonde Arrow, as he was known, was regarded as one of the greatest players, not only in Argentina, but in Spain, too. He helped Real Madrid win 8 league titles in the 1950s to early 60s. To remember Di Stefano, we reached writer Marcela Mora y Araujo in Buenos Aires. She interviewed the Blonde Arrow on several occasions.
One of the things that made him remarkable was his elegance, his lightness of touch, his ability to play all over the pitch to cover. He's known as the first modern footballer or even the first total footballer because he could play in any position. And the other thing that I think made him incredibly remarkable was his ability to bridge over the traditional tribes that football kind of delineates for us. Football makes us always want to be us or them. And in Argentina, it's Boca or River. And in the world, it's nationalities as well. Di Stefano bridged all this. So although he grew up in the neighborhood of La Boca, he actually played for River. He then managed both Boca and River at various points in his career.
Now, Boca, that was the neighborhood where he also grew up, Di Stefano. What kind of place is that? And how do you think those early days figure into his greatness?
Boca literally means mouth, and it's the port of Buenos Aires. It's the point at which all Europeans arrived first when they came to Argentina. The port of La Boca is where football first arrived, if you like, brought by British sailors. And it's an incredibly picturesque area with an enormous Italian influence, quite a poor neighborhood in many senses. And the Boca Juniors Football Club was founded there.
It sounds like he was not necessarily born into opportunity. Did he have to kind of fight to get where he was as a soccer player?
I think he was born into a lower middle class or a working class home in that neighborhood. He often made reference to when he was sent on errands by his father, he would play what we call keepy-uppy, which is that practice your skills, keeping a ball up in the air, with anything that he found, an old can or a rag of balls or a bit of paper. That's what he did all day long.
So born in Argentina, but he spent a lot of his career as a footballer abroad, first Colombia, then Spain with Real Madrid. I mean, that seems almost normal these days for footballers to hop around the world, but things were different when he was playing. Was there a lot of pressure for him to stay in Argentina?
The circumstances in which Di Stefano left Argentina are particularly interesting because it coincides with a time when the game was beginning to be professional and taken very seriously.
And we're talking the 1950s here, right?
Yes, in the 1940s even. Mm. And there was a huge strike by the footballers in Argentina. And the manager of River Plate, Adolfo Pedernera, took a job in Colombia. It became known as the Golden Time in Colombia, where they lured an enormous amount of Argentinian talent, mostly players that Pedernera had managed and that he took with them, Alfredo Di Stefano among them. And he told me he always felt very different, say, from the way younger footballers are sold and transferred around clubs nowadays, because he felt he had made this decision as an adult. and not sold by some agent or representative that's looking to kind of make enormous amounts of money with a multi-million dollar transfer, which is the kind of story we've become more accustomed to hearing now.
Yeah, but he was sold to Real Madrid, which is also an interesting story because I gather he almost played for rivals Barcelona.
Yes, whilst playing in Colombia, I think some kind of friendly or exhibition game that they played against Madrid, and Santiago Bernabeu, who was the president of Madrid, saw him play and said, I want him for my club no matter what.
And today in Argentina, how's Di Stefano viewed? I mean, Lionel Messi left Argentina to play for Barcelona. He was practically a child. Does Di Stefano have that same stigma, somebody who left, or is it different?
Di Stefano played in Argentina as a professional. He played as an adult. He returned to work here as an adult. Messi has only ever played professionally in Barcelona. I don't know if stigma is still the right word to use. For many years, people were claiming that Messi was somehow not Argentinian enough, or that he didn't sing the national anthem. Or Di Stefano actually took on Spanish nationality, represented Spain internationally. So in a sense, you'd think there could be more of a rebuttal to his Argentinianness. But I think Di Stefano is considered truly an Argentinian symbol and a source of pride.
Right.
He once said to me, one is a little bit from where one is born and a lot from where one is fed. But he recognized that the home he'd made and the country that had nurtured him and given him his career. But he also, even into his 80s, spoke completely like he'd never moved away from that Boca neighborhood, with the exact tones of that neighborhood, the slang of people his generation, the jokes. He would recite Martin Fierro, which is an epic poem about gaucho lifestyle. He would burst into tango. He was a very cheerful and curious and interested man. And you wouldn't know from talking to him that he'd lived more than half his adult life in another country.
Football writer Marcela Mora y Araujo speaking with me from Buenos Aires about the legendary Argentine footballer Alfredo Di Stefano. He died on Monday at the age of 88. Marcela, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And from the Nan and Bill Harris studios, I thank you for listening to The World.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, more at annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.